Hey, Latino USA listeners, it's Maria Hinojosa. And we know that you're always on the hunt for a good podcast. So why don't you check out NPR's Bullseye with Jesse Thorne? It's your guide to what's good in pop culture. Jesse Thorne talks with musicians, writers, filmmakers, and comedians about their work and their lives. Find your new favorite TV shows, books, movies, and music, and learn new insights into the things you already love. Find Bullseye now at iTunes under podcasts. From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. You wake up, I'm Maria Hinojosa, and I woke up like this. Today, questions of confidence at all ages. To start, what makes Latino kids seem shy in the classroom?
They were excited about the activity, and they were talking. They were really talking. I mean, you can hear, like, you can hear an orale or, you know, little things like that. And I'm like, oh my God.
And as we get older, how do Latinas reinvent ourselves as the powerhouses we really are? One woman has some ideas.
I believe that we have to focus also on giving from the inside, you know, and giving to the community and reinventing ourselves.
All this and more coming up on Latino USA as we talk about confidence. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. No se vayan. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And believe it or not, guys, I came up with this week's theme. Yep, I woke up like this. And yes, while I am a Beyoncé fan, it's actually another phenomenon that has inspired this show. Young, confident Latino women. I meet them every single day, whether they're my students at DePaul University where I teach, or they're women who are running their own companies. But in a public sphere, I'm also really impressed by Diane Guerrero. She's the Orange is the New Black actress who told the story of how her parents were deported in the middle of the day from her home in Los Angeles, going from silence to owning her voice.
About it. And I got home and their cars were there and dinner was started and the lights were on, but I couldn't find them. So it was really hard.
And 2 weeks ago, we did a segment where producer Daisy Rosario and I talked about how incredible Gina Rodriguez's Golden Globes acceptance speech was.
This award is so much more than myself. It represents a culture that wants to see themselves as heroes.
But when I was growing up, there were no Zoe Saldañas, Rosario Dawsons, or Cristela Alonsos that I could look up to. I mean, zero. So for this show, our youngest producer, Antonia Cerejido, and I decided to sit down in the studio to have a conversation about confidence and being a Latina and how important role models can be for your life. So, hey, Antonia.
Hey, Maria.
You know, when I was talking about this theme, you really latched onto it. And it wasn't about like, oh, popular culture, I woke up like this. You really understood that it was like, it's about how Latina women deal with, in so many ways, still being invisible or very stereotyped.
Right. Or just issues of confidence. And when you're a young Latina and there's three Latinas on TV, you know, those are the messages they're sending to you. So I remember, like, there was a show, Even Stevens, and the one Latina character on the whole show was Mandy Get Your Man Sanchez.
They just liked the alliteration, but they didn't realize that there was like a kind of racial slur there.
Well, we have now women like Rosario Dawson or Zoe Saldana who are like strong and show young women that you can be very empowered. But we still have like other kind of more problematic characters like Gloria from Modern Family.
So what about you, Antonia? I mean, I see you as incredibly confident. You're a young woman. You're a producer here. We encourage you with your ideas.
When I was young, I was very shy. And then part of it was language. I spoke Spanish at home. And so I couldn't understand what my classmates were saying. But then once I felt confident in my language and my ability to express myself, like, that's when, like, all hell broke loose. They couldn't shut me up.
And then that, how did that confidence manifest? Like, when you were a young woman, when you were a young Latina in high school, this worries me too, though, because while we have more and more young Latinas who are like, okay, this is it, we also know that Latina teenagers have the highest rate of attempted suicide, that there's a lot of depression. So where were the battles for you?
High school was a lot tougher for me. I was very studious. I was very dedicated. But I would have some of my best girlfriends say that the only reason I would get opportunities was because I was Latina. And I was like, you see me work, you know how hard I work. And yet you're saying these really hurtful things to me.
And were these other Latinas?
No, they were my white friends, and they love me, and we're still friends.
I think some people might be saying those are difficult friends to have.
Yeah, but it was also coming from a place of fear that I was stealing something, and I think that's when it all comes back to, like, Mandy, get your man Sanchez. To me, there is the difficult thing in confidence is when you're a woman and you're told that you're taking something from someone when you have it, and that's I think why a lot of Latinas struggle with feeling empowered, because they've been told that they're taking stuff and they don't want to take it. They want it to just be theirs because it's theirs.
That is so, so smart. So, Antonia, to start us off for this hour, you're actually going to take us to where these questions around self-confidence, am I good enough, where does it all start?
Well, some people might argue that it's in the classroom.
And you're taking us into an elementary school?
We're going to a classroom in Gainesville, Georgia, which is right outside of Atlanta.
All right, so what is your name?
Yahaira Soto.
Okay, now Yahaira, you've been in my class since August.
That's Jennifer Navarro Butler, a teacher at Lyman Hall Elementary in Gainesville, Georgia, talking to her fifth grade student, Yahaira Soto.
How do you think you were in the beginning of the class, in the beginning of the year?
I think I was a little bit more shy.
Why? Why do you think you were shy?
Because I kind of didn't raise my hand.
Uh-huh.
Yahaira Soto is first-generation Mexican-American, and her shyness can be described as an internalized behavior.
Which are behaviors that are directed more inward, so anxiety, depression.
Brian Collins is an assistant professor of bilingual education at Hunter College. He draws a distinction between internalized behaviors and externalized ones.
Aggression, conflict, hyperactivity. Many of the Latinos that are in the United States are facing many other barriers and struggles, which could contribute to higher incidence of internalizing, externalizing behaviors.
So it's not that these students are shy by nature. There are a series of factors that can make it difficult for Latino students to feel comfortable participating in class.
Latinos have been shown to have unique sets of values that they bring with them from their home countries.
Values like being able to work well collectively. But in the U.S. school system, where individual achievement and test results are emphasized, it can be difficult.
And now I see a difference. You were reading at a 24, and now you're at a 38, 40, which is a huge jump. Mommy, you should be at a 50, but I told you, you're going to get there by the end of the year.
Miss Butler is focused on measuring her students' reading comprehension, but she says her students are happy when they get to work in groups.
They were excited about the activity, and they were talking. They were really talking. I mean, you can hear an orale or little things like that. And I'm like, oh my God.
So working well collectively with peers is a value that may or may not translate into the U.S. classroom. But it's a whole other deal with authority figures. Many Latino families value respect for authority. Miss Butler, who grew up in a Puerto Rican household in New York City, says that like her students, she too held back from participating in class.
I think in the beginning it was more just to be respectful of your teachers. Like, I mean, I may have been loud with my friends, but once it was in class, no way. Like, it was just quiet.
Being loud can be viewed as being disrespectful. And there's a lot of respect for the teacher.
I saw that more as a teacher. I could recognize that fairly quickly from the parents' attitudes of really handing over the responsibility of education and trusting the education system towards the teacher.
So these parents aren't like some overactive PTA moms here in the U.S. who are always cued into what their children are learning. For many of the parents of Latino children, especially undocumented immigrants, taking the time to talk to their kids' teachers is just about impossible.
Because most of my parents, some of them are illegal, they're afraid to ask for the day off because if they don't come to work, they'll get fired. They're constantly afraid.
But that doesn't mean that they don't care about their children's education.
And they look for advice on how to raise their kids because they have questions they want to ask. They want to know what's going on.
And according to Vanessa Rodriguez, former middle school teacher and author of The Teaching Brain, knowing what's going on is key to students' and teachers' success.
So I often talk about having an awareness of the learner and then an awareness of yourself. For me, teaching is really an interaction.
For Ms. Butler, opening up to her students was a way to invite them to open up to her.
Like I tell them, like, listen, you know, I mean, I didn't live in this big house when I was a kid. I lived in a little apartment. You know, my father worked in a factory too. I don't know if maybe me being Hispanic too, they feel more comfortable. I don't know if that would, I don't know.
According to Rodriguez, a good teacher-student relationship does not have to be based on sharing a similar cultural background.
And in any interaction, it's really about understanding yourself so you can understand the other. We might argue that that's easier when you're more alike. And so in that context, it can seem like, you know, people teaching one another who are of the same race or culture or even socioeconomic class seems like a really great idea. But there's also a great loss in that. And so, you know, the diversity also helps us to figure out how to manage, you know, difficult relationships.
So up until now, we've talked about cultural barriers in the classroom. But there is another issue that is central to why many Latino students don't feel comfortable in class.
The language plays a huge factor here.
Brian Collins again.
So you can imagine if you were plopped down in China, for example, and you needed to eat and you knew no Chinese, you would try to communicate to people in the language English or Spanish in order to eat. And if nobody understood you, there would be a period where you'd have to step back and reassess and recognize they're not understanding English. And how am I going to communicate? And this happens to immigrant children as well. When they're immersed into a new linguistic setting, the school, they go through what's sometimes referred to as a silent period.
A silent period. Pretty much all second language learners go through one, including Yahaira.
She didn't really talk at all. And she can speak English, but she really had a silent period.
Most of Ms. Butler's students are second language learners.
So in my class alone, I have 28 students, and I believe 14 of them are ESL students.
ESL meaning ESL, or English as a Second Language. In 2011, Professor Collins and his colleagues published some research that showed that bilingual children were coming into elementary school with average to above average inter and intrapersonal skills.
We found that these strengths that these kids come into school at kindergarten and second grade, which are sometimes above and beyond what the average monolingual has, are attributed to in separate ways to their English ability and their Spanish abilities.
In other words, students can't use their skills as well in a language that is less familiar to them.
I use my Spanish every single day because if they don't get it in English, oh yeah, I mean, I go back and forth all day long.
Ms. Butler says the alternative is worse.
What happens is they become non-lingual.
And Ms. Butler is incredibly dedicated to her students succeeding.
But what does Ms. Butler always try to tell you guys?
To speak up.
Why? Why do you think I'm always telling you guys to speak up?
Because when you go to middle school, the teachers don't grade you or they're going to fail you if you don't speak up or raise your hand.
Ms. Butler is an example of a teacher who has built an individual relationship with her student. She knows Yahaira's family and school history, and that's what lets her address her specific issues. But there isn't a Ms. Butler for every Latino student out there.
Because our nation, our school system is becoming more Latino, it's upon us as educators that working in the school systems to better understand this new population.
For Latino USA, I'm Antonia Cerejido.
Coming up on Latino USA.
If you register, pass a criminal background check, and you're willing to pay your fair share of taxes, you'll be able to apply to stay in this country temporarily without fear of deportation.
But what happens to the thousands depending on presidential action when injunctions, stays, and delays shake their confidence? Stay with us. No se vayan. Boy.
I'll always be dedicated to the one I love. Yeah. Still on the way he talks.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Inada, maker of the Dreamwave massage chair, Japanese crafted with shiatsu point detection and 16 pre-programmed massages, including morning, night, and full body sessions. Learn more at dreamwavechair.com. And Emily and Antoine Van Ochtmail, supporting New Futures, which works to help low-income D.C. area youth graduate from community college or certificate programs and become financially self-sufficient. Information is available at newfuturesdc.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. So remember back in November when President Obama made his big immigration announcement?
You'll be able to apply to stay in this country temporarily without fear of deportation. You can come out of the shadows and get right with the law.
Under Obama's actions, over 5 million undocumented immigrants would be eligible for protected status. But last week,
just one day before part of the orders were set to go into effect, a federal Texas judge issued a temporary injunction, siding with the 26 states suing to block the president's orders.
The Texas judge decided that Obama's action was an overreach of his presidential powers. The injunction effectively stops the action in its tracks for now. At the time I'm reading this, the Justice Department had appealed the judge's decision. So by the time you hear this report, it's possible that the situation might have already changed. But here's what doesn't change. There's a constant back and forth that makes it really hard for immigrants to find solid ground and plan for the future. It's something I've called the U.S. Mambo. Here's how you dance it. Just like in the regular mambo, you take two steps forward. You know, let's say like in the summer of 2013, when the Senate passed an immigration reform bill.
A bipartisan Senate majority today passed historic legislation reforming the nation's immigration system.
Then you take a spin and you take two steps back, like what happened shortly after.
The House is not going to take up and vote on whatever the Senate passes.
Oh, no!
But maybe there's a chance this broken system can be reformed. Step forward again. January 2014. Obama says he's open to taking executive action to fix immigration.
Woo!
But then in April, he tells faith leaders there will be no executive action on immigration.
Aww.
And finally, Obama's executive action arrives. Congratulations! You can stay. You took the right steps forward. Whoops, but wait a second. Here comes an injunction. It looks like you gotta go, and now you're taking two steps back. Here to talk about how the immigration mambo is affecting immigrants themselves is Angela Fernandez. She's a lawyer and the director of the Northern Manhattan Coalition for Immigrant Rights. They're a nonprofit advocacy center and legal clinic that helps immigrants apply for legal status. Welcome back to Latino USA, Angela.
Thank you very much.
So what do you think about this thing, the U.S. mambo around immigration, three steps forward, two steps back?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, historically in the United States, there has been a love-hate with immigrants. You know, we love immigrants when they come here and work for us, but we don't like it when they start demanding rights. And that's what we've been seeing over the last 20 years.
So what were you hearing right after the judge stayed Obama's executive action?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. For one woman I know, she was very disappointed. She has three children. And she said, you know, I'm actually not surprised that this happened. It was almost too good to be true after living here for over 10 years that we would actually have some path and some way to regularize.
So for people who might not understand, what are the two kinds of protections and where do they stand right now?
A little over 2 years ago, President Obama entered an executive action called DACA.
Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals.
Exactly. Right. So Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, also known as DACA, provides a benefit to anyone who's come into this country before the age of 16, and they have to be below the age of 30, and either have graduated from high school, are enrolled in college, are in the military, or are enrolled in a GED program or ESL program. They can apply for what's called work authorization and will also get a stay from deportation. So they won't be deported. What President Obama announced a few months ago was an expansion of DACA. DAPA, Deferred Action for Parents of Americans, confers a similar benefit to a parent who has a U.S. citizen child or a child that has a green card, but it does not provide a path to citizenship, which is something that only Congress can do, which is something that we've been pushing for over the last 10 years.
So how does all of this back and forth, you know, this U.S. mambo on immigration policy, affect the confidence of immigrants and their ability to trust in the U.S. government when they're applying for the programs?
Well, what we have seen is that once a program begins in the United States that expands the rights of immigrants, we have rarely seen it pull back once they've actually received those rights.
But you know that because you've studied American history and law. But for the immigrants who are coming in, are they thinking, my God, I'm about to put all of my information down into a document that the federal government is going to have, telling me they're going to protect me. But wait a second. The judge just said that I'm no longer protected. They have all of my information now. They're going to come and get me.
I think that definitely this injunction has created a level of fear and a lack of confidence. What I can see happening is that you will have some people, if let's say the injunction is lifted and then people can go apply, you will have a group of people who will apply. I can see people hanging back and waiting to see what would happen. We saw that with DACA. It was the number of people who applied for DACA 2 years ago was much lower than expected. And then 2 years down the road, our organization, we had a huge DACA event and we had 100 youth come to our organization in one Saturday. We completely did not expect those numbers. And when we spoke to them and asked them, did you know about this? Some of them didn't even know about the program. Some of them did, but they wanted to wait and see. And when they saw that no one was being rounded up and deported after applying for DACA, they felt more confident applying.
So what do you think is the end game here?
Well, I do think that the executive action is ultimately going to pass. I think the injunction is going to be lifted. I don't think that we are going to see immigration reform in Congress until we see until we see not only Latinos, the Asian community, other communities use their political power to get people into Congress that will actually vote in our interests. I think that the Dreamers, so the youth that are benefiting from DACA right now, they became very politically involved at very young age, 14, 15, 16, 17. Those are our future members of Congress in about 20 years. And so I'm very excited about the fact that we've had the light at the end of the tunnel of all of this frustration around immigration reform is that it's producing our future political representatives down the road. And I think that that's where we're going to see real changes.
It's funny, Angela. This is the one moment in the interview where it's like you're absolutely 100% convinced and sure and confident that there will be a new surge of Latino and other immigrant activists who then become a part of the American political system.
Mm-hmm. And I think that is the only, I mean, number one, that's the American way. And that's the only way we're going to have the kind of change that is really deeply embedded in one part of our American history, which is that inclusiveness. There are other parts of our American history that is about exclusion and about control and about abuse. Let's try and remove that from our history, or rather remove that from our future, and expand on this inclusiveness, on rights, on equality, that is also another part of our history.
Angela Fernandez, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak with you.
Angela Fernandez is the director of the Northern Manhattan Coalition for Immigrant Rights. She joined us in our studios in Harlem. And now, understanding the coded and not so coded language that tells us women to curb our ambitions, to be non-threatening, to downplay our successes. and as women of color, to believe that our success is not really earned. But here's one Latina who rose from poverty as a child to success as a businesswoman even before she finished high school. Zoe Damasela, the owner and creator of Zoe Damasela Apparel. As a teenager, Zoe appeared on the Tyra Banks Show. She was featured in the Chicago Tribune and on the cover of 17 magazine. She was invited twice to meet with President Obama at the White House as a promising young businesswoman. Today, Zoe is 22. She graduated last year from Northwestern University and moved to New York City to work as a designer for Macy's and for her own brand. We went to her apartment in Brooklyn, where she lives and works with fellow designer and boyfriend, Brian Longwill. And here, she tells us her story.
Here is our sewing room. This is kind of where we make everything. My childhood, I guess, growing up was pretty interesting, I guess you could say. My mom was a single mother. She came to the U.S. from Ecuador, had me when she was very young, and so, you know, we lived in homeless shelters, and constantly being the poor kid in class, I was always in hand-me-downs. Like, I got clothes from a church or from Salvation Army, and so to be able to come up with an idea and draw it out and not only stop there, but make something that I could wear that made me feel not only like I had cool clothes to wear, but that I created this from nothing. I think that was a really, really empowering sort of realization. I first learned how to sew when I was about 12 or 13, and then I really started to get into it by the time I was about 14. And I remember going to fashion shows and showing my collections in shows, and I would have assistants who were sometimes in college and I was in high school, and even with my mom sometimes. And I'd go to these shows and they would always address my mom like, "Oh, are you Zoe Damasela? Is this your collection?" And my mom would be like, "Nope, that's my daughter." And it would be like little 15-year-old me like, "No, it's me." Oh my gosh, my mom is my biggest role model. She is the feistiest, most confident woman. She always raised me to be strong and independent and self-reliant and always a problem solver. I think when you grow up and you grow up with a mother who's constantly like, "Oh, my thighs are too fat and I have all these wrinkles and I have all these stretch marks," and you know, you start to think like, that's what I'm gonna become or that's what I am, and you start picking out your own flaws and you say like, "Oh, well, these are all the things that are wrong with me." But when you grow up with a mom who's like, "Everything about myself is great and everything about you is great too and you're perfect just the way you are, just like I'm perfect just the way I am," growing up with someone who's as strong-willed as that and vocal about being proud of and celebrating their own bodies makes a huge difference. I definitely feel like after a hard day, just cutting fabric can be really relaxing. Like the sound and the feel of scissors just slicing through fabric is kind of like zen. But if I'm like really hyped up and I have a lot of energy, it can be really satisfying to just like zoom through the machine and start putting pieces together and seeing it all sort of come together. As much as I was confident from my upbringing, as much confidence as I had from the things that I had accomplished in my life, I still, much like a lot of women, got sort of misled by someone who was a manipulator. Something went wrong with the threads here, and the machine decided that it does not like me today. So now we'd have to rethread the entire machine. I was in this relationship with this man, and he was always very jealous, very controlling, very abusive. And there was actually one night where he started an argument with me, and we were on our rooftop in New York, and he literally picked me up and held me all over the side of the roof and threatened to let me go. And I thought, this is the moment that I could die. And it was weird. It was like, even then, the thought that was going through my mind was like, well, if only you wouldn't make him so mad, then this wouldn't happen to you. And if only you would be a better girlfriend, then this wouldn't happen to you. And maybe you should stop focusing so much on your business or whatever, and you should focus on being a better girlfriend to your partner, whatever. I got down from the roof, whatever, and got back into our apartment. Then I like took a second, calmed down, and realized this is crazy. Like, this is way out of control. And when I realized it's not you, you don't have control over this. You have control over so many other things in your life, but this is not something that's your fault, and it's not something that you can control. It took me a while, but after thinking about it and coming to that realization, I literally had to throw everything that I could into a suitcase. I literally took a bus overnight from New York to Pittsburgh, and I went to my aunt's house just to get away from the city, and I escaped from that. I had so-called friends in high school who said, oh, well, I would have gotten into a good school too, but I didn't because of affirmative action. Like, the reason why you got accepted into this school is because they had to pick someone who was a person of color, or they had to pick a certain percentage of women. If everything had been fair, then they would have gotten that spot. And that's insane, ridiculous. And it's definitely something that you constantly have to deal with. It's not only with getting into school, getting into colleges, but it's like when you get jobs, or when you get awards for something, or when you get recognition for something, there's always somebody saying, well, they had to pick that person because they're a person of color, or well, they had to pick that woman because they needed a certain percentage of women to get whatever it is. I think that can be really hard, because it sort of is completely untrue and unfair, because everything that we do accomplish is through our own merit, but it's even more disrespectful and completely wrong because of the overwhelming odds that are against us as women of color. So I think, like, freeing yourself from other people's comments can be something that's a little bit challenging, but something that you absolutely have to do if you plan on accomplishing anything in the world.
That was fashion designer and entrepreneur Zoe Damasela. Latino USA's Camilo Vargas produced our story. Coming up on Latino USA, a cafe providing stability and security for people coming home from jail.
We're looking for guys that are on the margins, or we'll say that guys that are struggling, guys that are not doing well. A guy comes home from jail, we'd be very interested in them. That would be someone we would kind of give preference to.
The simple confidence that comes with a good job. Stay with us. No se vayan. Hey, Latino USA listeners, it's Maria Hinojosa. And we know that you're always on the hunt for a good podcast. So why don't you check out NPR's Bullseye with Jesse Thorne? It's your guide to what's good in pop culture. Jesse Thorne talks with musicians, writers, filmmakers, and comedians about their work and their lives. Find your new favorite TV shows, books, movies, and music, and learn new insights into the things you already love. Find Bullseye now at iTunes under podcasts.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Lumber Liquidators, offering a variety of sustainably harvested flooring, including pre-finished and stained, exotic and domestic hardwood, bamboo, and cork. Learn more at lumberliquidators.com or 1-800-HARDWOOD. And the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, helping people build measurably better lives, supporting efforts to improve women's economic opportunities around the world. More information is available at hewlett.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. There are days, many, when I look in the mirror and I say, what? I'm getting older. How did this happen? For Latinas, getting older can get complicated in some very particular ways. But, of course, getting older doesn't have to be scary. There's a lot of advice out there. And one friend of Latino USA is actually providing a lot of it. Lorraine Laddish is the founder of a new website called Viva50.com. Welcome back to Latino USA, Lorraine.
Thank you. It's always wonderful to be with you.
Yeah, mamita. So you are 50 what now?
51, turning 52 in August.
Okay, turning 52. But you do not carry yourself in any way, shape, or form. And that's even weird because like to say like a 50-year-old, it's like Gloria Estefan is a 50-year-old. I mean, Salma Hayek is almost 50.
Yes.
So when we think of, you know, the mind of a 50-year-old, it's like we're actually having to create that mind out of nothing because it's an image that we're clearly not a part of.
This is a funny thing, is that when somebody says to me, oh, so-and-so who's 40-some or 50, I'm thinking, oh, wow, those guys are old. And then I think, wow, but wait a minute, I'm older than that. And this is what I wanted to do with Viva 50 is, well, one thing is that a lot of my peers who are younger or my age or older, I find it very, very sad that they have to fight ageism and they can't find jobs or they can't say their age in public. I wanted to create a place of empowerment where women mostly would be able to say, well, this is how old I am. This is what I'm going through. I might be going through menopause, which I am going through, and be able to talk about it like it's normal because it is. And realizing that when we're 70, we'll look back and think, wow, I really was young at 50 or at 60.
I know, but it's interesting because it's like, do I really want to reveal my age right about right now? Do I really want to reveal anything about menopause? Because there is this sense of like, esas cosas no se hablan. But at the same time, you know, I think you and I both are about, look, it's honest, it's the truth, it's who we are. But also the other truth, Lorraine, is that, as you know, every 90 seconds, a Latino turns 18 in the United States of America, which means that the focus is really on the young, on the younger population. Why did you decide that you wanted to target Latinos 50 and above?
First of all, because other than the AARP, who are my lovely clients, by the way, there is really nothing out there that is bilingual. There are a lot of sites for over 50s, but I did not find anything that spoke to women, especially again, because those are, you know, we are the ones who really seek out more information. And what the Anglo audience is looking for might be a little different from what the Spanish-speaking or even bilingual Latina is looking for. You know, I talk a lot about things, as you said, that people do not address, menopause and the symptoms. And, you know, why can't we talk about pregnancy and all the good and the bad? And I found so many people who have written to me and messaged me on the page saying, oh, I'm so glad that you're talking about this because I'm white-knuckling it. My husband doesn't know what I'm going through. Our demographic is a lot different from our moms and our abuelitas. You know, we're computer savvy. We're on social media. We are active. I'm a marathon runner. I mean, there are so many things that we can do, and we have the spending power that the younger people do not have.
Yeah, I guess one of the things for me, the best part about getting older is, especially at a time when I've lost friends, right? Because it's just like, wait a second, I lost two of my best friends in the world. One was 50, the other one was 52. Jóvenes, one was a trainer, the other one was a photographer stylist. They should be here. But that loss has also taught me, like, do not hold back. Life is about joy. It's complicated, but it's about joy. And I wonder about that good part of being post 50, where it's just like, one way or another, I'm going to make this a phenomenal day. de alguna manera. Is there a part of you that the Latina part of you that's like, I'm going to dance? Or
I am going to dance. I still do. You know, in the past month, I've been thinking about this a lot because one of my best friends passed from cancer and a number of things. That was a very hard loss. But in the same week, I discovered that a friend is going through chemotherapy. A 29-year-old son of another friend of mine was killed in a car crash. But then the same week, a friend of mine got engaged. Somebody else had a baby. That's life.
So right now, for example, Lauren, here's an interesting dynamic in my own life. One of my best friends is battling a very difficult cancer, you know. And on the other hand, my husband, who is, I think, now going to turn 59, amazing, he has decided that he wants to perform on stage. And so he created an album, wrote an album, is singing an album, is performing and dancing on stage. Both of these things are happening post 50. Mm-hmm. Is that the lesson that you're also learning in your life, which is just like, and that's the way it is since forever. It's just, you know, the give and take.
It happens at all stages of life. I just think that in the same way that when you're pregnant, you notice pregnant women more and everybody seems to be pregnant. So when you're older and, you know, things start happening to your friends. Yes, they die. Yes, they have cancer. Yes, you know, illnesses. But I do remember that when I was very young, friends were killed in car accidents or because of drugs or because of something else. But we weren't so scared. Now it is true that, man, I did have my colonoscopy last year because I don't want to, you know, have colon cancer. And so I take all the precautions. That I know that that's no guarantee. And it is true that, you know, we feel, oh, wow, you know, we are going to die. But again, there's my abuelita, 98. There she is. You know, I might get the call tomorrow. Hopefully not. Even though I have my own bad days, of course, I'm not always this bubbly person that people know me as. But if we consider, wow, well, what can I do? What can I do today? I know 30-year-olds who are old. You know, they carry themselves in an old way. They feel old. They are jaded. They will not go into a relationship. They will not, you know. But then there are people like my own husband who was publishing his first novel at 50. So it's all in your attitude.
What is it in particular about Latinas approaching post-50 that makes us unique to kind of lead the conversation about retirement as we become the new retirees?
In a way, Latinas have been very focused like on beauty for, you know, it's I don't think it's a bad thing. But I believe that we have to focus also on giving from the inside, you know, and giving to the community and reinventing ourselves and figuring out how we can live the second half, hopefully, what is the second half of our lives, with enthusiasm and show the world that we're not going to just stay home and crochet, which is fine because I crochet too, but
you run marathons and you crochet.
And I crochet. Yeah, I actually did. My abuelita taught me. But, you know, I have to say that last year or 2 years ago when I met Rita Moreno and Charo and we were with Nelly Galan in the press room, and one of them said something that was amazing, and is that age humbles everybody. You know, there comes a moment when life humbles you because you've gone through so much. And then you realize what is really, really important and what really doesn't matter. So it's a beautiful time to really enjoy what we can do and try to give to our kids, to our, again, grandchildren, to our friends, to the younger generation, and learn from them as well. So I think that as older Latinas, it is very important to stay relevant. That is what I would say to women. Stay relevant. Use social media. Put yourself out there. Stop complaining that you can't get a job and make one for yourself. I'm sure if, you know, by telling my age, I would probably not get a job, but I sure made a career out of it. So, you know.
So if you had to share some words of wisdom from the women, the Latinas and Latinos over 50, what would that be? Is there in fact a cultural difference or not?
So I go back and forth and I wonder about that a lot. You know, I was telling my abuelita that does not wear jeans, for example, like, abuelita, I'm going to buy you a pair of jeans. And she laughs, you know, and she's from a different culture that does not wear jeans at, you know, any age, really. But so I'm not quite sure, but I think that if there is not a culture of empowerment after a certain age, we really, it's in our hands to build it. So my I don't have words of wisdom, really, but I would say, again, stay relevant and learn from younger people and teach them, too. You know, if as you said at the very beginning, it's all how you conduct yourself. You know, if you act old and you act jaded and all that, it doesn't matter how old you are. You're basically dating yourself. And if you're open and enthusiastic about life, even if you have hard days, even if you have really horrible challenges, which we all do, then life will be kinder to you, whether you're Latino or you're not.
Lorraine Laddish is the former editor-in-chief of Mommyverse, and she's now the founder of Viva50.com. Congratulations, Lorraine.
Oye, besitos, besitos, and thank you. Thank you so much.
Felicidades.
I remember being young and so brave. I knew what I needed. I was spending all my nights and days, laid back, daydreaming. But look at me, I'm a big girl now. Said I'm gonna do something. Told the world I would paint this town. Now bet you I'll run this.
And now for some words of wisdom. A little sabiduría. There's a coffee shop here in New York City that serves up a lot more than cappuccinos. Father Jim O'Shea and Efrain Hernandez started a project called Reconnect. It was a way to get kids out of gangs and keep them off the street. Now they run a cafe, a bakery, and a graphic design company that employs a couple of dozen young men. 85% of them go on to keep good jobs and stay out of jail. Here's an audio postcard from Bedford-Stuyvesant, a Brooklyn neighborhood.
We have our signature cookie called a Best Eye Cookie, which I would like for you to try it. It's called the Best Eye Cookie, basically describing the neighborhood. A little rough on the outside, but it's sweet on the inside. The people are still good people at heart.
My name is Jim O'Shea.
My name is Efrain Hernandez. I am from Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn.
So Efrain is the co-director of the Vernon Avenue Project, to Reconnect.
And Jim O'Shea is my friend, my partner. He's like a father figure, so he's like a lot of things to me.
And he's the manager of the cafe, and he's a lifelong resident of Bedford-Stuyvesant. I met him when he was 13 years old.
Two of my best friends introduced me to him. He ran an after-school program at PS23.
He had his own personal tragedies with his friends being victims of crime. And I think a lot of that fueled, and his own life fueled kind of a rethinking and then a re-engagement through leadership and Reconnect.
And the rest is history, so I know about 16 years now.
Nothing values someone like a paycheck. The goal is to figure out how to get somebody engaged. And that takes time sometimes. So people make mistakes, people fall off, they come back. This idea of zero tolerance or two strikes in your head, that's doping.
Just to get a little deeper, so I feel like I owe the neighborhood this, over to Father Jim and to my two best friends, because they introduced me to this man, and they are no longer here. They were both murdered.
We started specifically during a time of violence. So it was during, there's two blocks on either side of us, Vernon Avenue and Hart Street, which is a couple blocks up. And there was a war going on between these two groups of young people, young men. The idea of the cafe was to say, all right, why can't we put on the same block a business? And the business is the same business as if you sell drugs, you're going to sell apples now.
Cappuccino. $3 total. Thank you.
Enjoy your day.
You too.
Thank you.
So Reconnect Bakery is again, we outfitted it probably a year ago. We just started it, though. It launched it as kind of a full-time business. The model that we use for all the businesses is they have to be, within a year or so, self-sustaining. They have to produce enough income to at least cover their costs, so there is zero loss.
I was incarcerated for something that I had did when I was a teenager, and it finally caught up to me, but it was the best thing because it gave me time to sit down and think about life, and who knows if I would have been here today if I wasn't incarcerated. You know, I could have been in a car with my best friend that day. You never know.
We're looking for guys that are on the margins, or we'll say that guys that are struggling, guys that are not doing well. A guy comes home from jail, we'd be very interested in them. That would be someone we would kind of give preference to. Anybody that's really on the edge is really the person that we want.
This is home to me. This is my neighborhood, and has a soft spot in my heart. It's just, you know, growing up in a neighborhood where there really isn't too much to do, you know. You don't have too many resources out here, so young guys get into the wrong things, wrong recreational things to do, you know.
You know, and sometimes guys coming out of jail are the best ones because they get there, you know, they've woken up and they say, you know, I don't, the last thing I want to do is spend the rest of my life in jail. They get a certain amount of maturity, a little bit of wisdom. And sometimes they're much better than the knucklehead who never woke up.
When I came home, I said, I'm going to give Reconnect blood, sweat, and tears. And 3-4 years later, we have the cafe, we have a bakery, and started a t-shirt business, Reconnect Graphics. And I just keep on trying to create jobs for the youth in the neighborhood and give them something positive to do.
Some words of wisdom from the Reconnect Cafe and Bakery. Our piece was produced by Sarah Barrett. One more thing, mis queridos. Do me a favor. If you're near a computer, open a web browser, type in itunes.com/LatinoUSA. Try it. You're going to find hours of stories, interviews, and more that are now at your fingertips. It's as simple as that. And how about if you click on that subscribe button? Gracias, everyone. That's it for this week. Latino USA is produced by AC Valdez, Lita Hartman, Daisy Rosario, Marlon Bishop, Michael Simon Johnson, Camilo Vargas, and Antonia Cerejido. Our engineer is Cornelius McMoyler. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Our intern is Laura Calzada. Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen. Special thanks this week to Mitra Caboli for her production help. Our show is founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week, and in the meantime, look for us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr, and I'll see you on Instagram. Hasta la próxima.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all. The Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. And the Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and the strengthening of international peace and security at carnegie.org.
Jim O'Shea.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Lemelson Foundation, committed to improving lives through invention in the U.S. and developing countries, on the web at lemelson.org. And the Pew Charitable Trusts, driven by the power of knowledge to solve today's most challenging problems, at pewtrusts.org. This is NPR.
Queridos y queridas, if you love what we do here at Latino USA, I hope you'll take a moment to go to latinousa.org and click on the donate button to support our work. As you know, we're a nonprofit, so contributions from you, no matter what the size, are what makes this podcast possible. Gracias for believing in what we do. Do help us, y hasta la próxima.